Romans chapter 13, we're picking up where we left off September the 5th. The following week was our church's anniversary, and then last week we went on a short jaunt. And picking up where we left off last time, Romans 13, which does require just a little bit of review, but we'll read the passage first. This is one of the more used passages to both support the American Revolution and against the American Revolution. And you'll see perhaps why that's so as we read it. So Romans 13, verses 1 through 7. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore ye must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause, pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom is, custom to custom, to whom fear, honor, to whom honor. So we're looking at the American Revolution and the Bible, and whether the American Revolution was justified from a biblical perspective. And so along with that, I am asking the question, who is the king in America? That's one of the reasons I felt it necessary, both Brandon and I, to address this topic because of where we are as a nation today, but not just now. I mean, this has been a question I've had in my mind for years, and I started taking notes as far back as 2013, I believe, so 8 years. And I've got like 70 to 80 pages of notes on my computer. A lot of things I copied and pasted. Don't be impressed that I wrote all these notes. These are a lot of copied and pasted type notes that I began doing years ago when somebody asked me the question about how do we treat those in authority? Because Obama was the president, and it was really hard to submit to him. And people thought, well, we're just to put whatever he says, we do. Well, is that true? Okay, so Romans 13, 1. Here's a little bit of review. We're looking at verse 1 here. And you may want to look at your Bibles as I go through this. This is review. There's no doubt, according to verse 1, that a Christian is to obey the powers. Literally, the authority or the authorities. There's two words for power in the Bible. One is dunamis, which literally has to do with a dynamite type power. The other is exousia, which has to do with authority. Somebody who is in power, he's my authority, okay? And that's what is being taught here, that we are to be subject. There is no doubt. You cannot deny that. I mean, it says right there, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. The question is, who or what is the ultimate authority or the king in America? Who is that authority? Because of the way our Constitution, the way our constitutional federal republic was established. Because we have a nation without one king. Is it the president then? Is it the U.S. Senate? Is it the House of Representatives or the Congress, the U.S. House with the Senate? Who's the authority? Is it the Supreme Court? Who is the authority? This is the question we've been asking. And I have stated that in America, the highly placed authority, the king, is, it's the Constitution. Now, people will come back at that and say, well, it's talking about people here. It's not talking about a thing. But you look at the verse, you look at verses 1 and 2, and in verses 1 and 2, it's talking, what word is it using for those who we are to submit? What's the word that's used? Powers or authority. You'll notice that you get to verse 3, and now it refers to what word? Rulers. So it's talking about authorities, and then it changes to rulers. Same thing? Possibly. So in America, the highly placed authority, I believe, and I'm going to make that clear, because if somebody else says no, it's got to be. It's got to be the president. Really? So what if the president does something that is unconstitutional? What do you do? And by the way, Biden has been doing all kinds of things that counter the Constitution. So I just obey him, a lawbreaker? So you see the conundrum. Well, the Supreme Court. Well, the Supreme Court has overruled what he's been doing. So now you've got the president saying one thing, the Supreme Court saying another thing. Who's the authority? It's like a child. A child, when he does not know who the authority is, becomes exasperated. And the Bible talks about that in Colossians chapter 3, that children, that parents are not to exasperate their children. Because mom says one thing, dad says another thing, and there's confusion. That's what's happening in our country. And it's not the way it's supposed to be. And yet people are saying, well, that's, you know, we need to obey the president. Really? There's a problem with that. And so I mentioned the statement, the position statement of the FBFI adopted June 2021 that says, in countries where there is no ultimate human ruler, the king, which believers should honor, is the network of laws, institutions, and officials that make up the system of government. That's confusing. So the king is a network now. And the problem that is established by that statement, which I disagree with and I did not vote on, is that when they all disagree with each other, when the institutions that have been established, like the Supreme Court, disagrees with the officials, like the president and others, now what do? So it only causes confusion. So we went into Romans chapter, we went to verse 13:2 now, and it talks about the seriousness of this. Whosoever therefore resisteth the authority resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Damnation is a judicial sentence. It's not eternal punishment. It's talking about the right that that magistrate has to mete out the justice in this case. So the one who opposes the authority in America, which is... Okay, let's pick up. So if somebody opposes the authority in America, which is Constitution. I mean, now that's my opinion. And I am very much accepting the fact that people will disagree with me. But as I've studied the Bible, I believe it has to do that in our country, that's who the highly placed authority would be. So if somebody opposes the Constitution, what happens to that person? Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. They shall receive punishment. Thus, the one who opposes the authority in America, the Constitution that was ordained of God, is resisting the ordinance of God. We go on to chapter, verse 3. And here the wording changes from the authority to rulers, the ones literally who are ruling. Thus, the ones who are ruling are not a cause of fear to those who do good works. Who ultimately decides what is good and what is bad? Because in verse 3, it talks about good works and evil. Who ultimately is the arbiter of what is good and what's bad? God is. If the Constitution is the authority, maybe I should say since it is the authority, does it not say this is what is good and this is what is bad? I believe so. So, What does an authority that is ordained of God look like? Rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the authority? It goes back to authority. The authority and the rulers. What if the rulers don't obey the authority? Is that possible for a ruler not to obey the authority? Has there ever been a rogue cop? You know, everybody acknowledges that. Oh yeah, that cop went way off and he did what was uncut. What do they do to him? They prosecute him. Especially today. They try to find anything and everything. But then we're supposed to believe that those who are way up high never do wrong? Brandon? Wow. Even their bodies.
Yeah, that's the phrasing that he uses.
Wow. You know that quote. That's slavery. That's tyranny. Brad. Right. Karen? Well, that's one of the reasons the founding fathers had so much against Roman Catholicism. People don't understand this, but they were strongly Protestant and were very much afraid of Roman Catholics ever coming into power. When John Kennedy became president in the 1960s, the Protestants in this nation were up in arms about who he was. Now we've got a second Catholic president, and you can see what he's doing to our nation because they don't understand authority structure. They become very tyrannical. When Roman Catholicism gets into power, it's tyranny. And that's what takes place when you have a replacement theology of Roman Catholicism called Anglicanism. They have the same idea. Tyranny. And that's the way they rule. The United States of America was founded by people who came across to escape a lot of religious persecution and other things. But that's one of the reasons that they were very much afraid of Roman Catholics ever coming into power. So, as we look at this, look at Romans chapter 13 again and look at verse 3, where it says, do that which is good. Do that which is good. Now that's a command. We are to do that which is good. I am commanded to do what is good. And then it says, and thou shalt have praise of the same. It's talking about the rulers. So I am commended for doing good. Do you find today, let's bring it up to this 21st century, do you find it today that people in America are being commended for doing what's good? No. So what does that say of the authority? Something's not right. Just to, you know, put it very simply. And you compare what is said in Romans 13:3, 1 Peter 2, 13 and 14, because this is one of the other passages that some people use to say, you know, whatever the king says, whatever the president says, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man. By the way, it's talking about an ordinance right there. For the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, we don't have a king, or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, for the praise of them that do well. The part I wanted to key in on, the punishment of what kind of doers? Evildoers, and praise of them that do well. That is always what will take place under a rightful government. We looked at the Magdeburg Confession back in 1550. The magistrate is an ordinance of God for the honor to good works and a terror to evil works, Romans 13. Therefore, when he begins to be a terror to good works and honor to evil, there is no longer in him, because he does thus, the ordinance of God, but the ordinance of the devil. And he who resists such works does not resist the ordinance of God. He resists the ordinance of the devil. The last thing I left you with last time was this verse, 2 Samuel 23:3, where David says this, the God of Israel said, the rock of Israel spake to me, he that ruleth over men must be just. He must do what is righteous, ruling in the fear of God. David was one of the few kings who did that. He had a tremendous kingdom. Solomon took over, did the same until the latter part of his life. You had other kings that followed, the kings of Judah. None of those of Israel did this, but kings of Judah, Hezekiah, Asa, Josiah, and so forth, men who ruled, for the most part, very justly. Let me ask you this question. This is a question for discussion. Are all kings and princes established with God's approval? I don't want to have a discussion on this. I just want you to answer that question in your own minds. Are all kings and princes established with God's approval? While you're thinking about that, go to Hosea. Hosea chapter 8. Old Testament, folks. Daniel, Hosea. Verse 1. Set the trumpet to thy mouth. He shall come as an eagle against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. Israel shall cry unto me, my God, we know you. Verse 3. Israel hath cast off the thing that is good, the enemy shall pursue him. Verse 4, they have set up kings, but not by me. They have made princes, and I knew it not. And so forth, it goes on. But the part I really want to emphasize is that Israel has set up kings, but not by me. They have made princes, and I knew it not. Does that mean that God did not know what was happening? Is God not omniscient? Then what does it mean when it says, they made princes and I knew it not? Bruce. That's right. That's exactly what, in the same sense, well, I thought it was on there, in the same sense that you read this in Psalm 1:6. For the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. That word knoweth there has the sense of what Bruce just said. He knoweth, he approves of the way of the righteous. In this case, they set up princes and God did not approve. So there are instances where a nation will set up a king that God did not approve. Now, this becomes a very controversial thing here. Can something be God's will without being something he approved? Who said yes? Can you give me an instance in Scripture? Because the answer is yes. Brandon. Okay. Yeah, but God regretted he ever made him king. But that is a good one. Think about Joseph. Was it God's will that those men threw Joseph into the pit? Was it his will? Is it something God approved? No, God never approves of that. But was it his will? Boy, you get into some real messy stuff here when you think of this. Because that's how God brought Israel into Egypt to be taken care of. Joseph even admits this later on. God, what you did for evil purposes, but God meant it for good. So I readily admit the fact that it does cause confusion. So when you read Hosea 8:3 and 4, they have set up kings, but not by me. They have made princes as I knew it not. That seems to contradict Romans 13. So we move on. Romans 13:4. And I've got to get back there too. For he, that is the ruler, is the minister of God. That word minister is servant. Remember we talked about public servants? He is the servant of God to thee for what? For good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God. He's the servant of God. A revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Every policeman, in fact, I know police chaplains. You may know Larry Robbins down in Westminster, who is a police chaplain. When he does a ride along with these police, he's told me that he tells these policemen, he says, did you know that you are ministers of God? And they almost hit the brakes, you know. What? Yeah, you're a minister of God. And he reads them Romans 13:4. You are the minister of God. And he's trying to impress upon them not arrogance, but humility. You are carrying out what God wants done for good, not for evil. Think about it. Those in power are supposed to be ministers of God who do that which is good. Again, who defines ultimately what is good? God does. Let's say that you're stopped by a policeman and he comes up to your door. He opens your door. He grabs you. He pulls you out. He slams you up against the car. He starts searching. He hasn't said a word. Can he do that? And then he handcuffs you. Sir, why are you handcuffing me? He says nothing. What do you do? Is this legal? And then he throws you into his vehicle. And he takes you off. He hasn't said a word. Is this legal? Do you have a responsibility to submit to him in everything he does? He rifles through your car. He starts taking things. He starts throwing them. Another guy drives along and he starts putting things in that guy's car and that guy takes off. Is this legal? Do you submit to him? Is he really an authority? You begin to wonder. This guy's rogue. He showed me his badge, but I bet you he's not real. What do you do? Now let's go to a higher level. The president says, we're going to take your property. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the government. What are you supposed to do? Just submit? Is he doing what's good? Now people go, well, good is relative. Who defines good? We know that God does. Specifically when it comes to good in our country, our Constitution does. Do they have the right to search you without a warrant? You say, this is illegal. Now what? You see, we would never allow that for a lower magistrate, a cop. But we're allowing it way up there in D.C.? That's just by way of illustration. My sister, my nephew was murdered last October. And this trial's been going on for quite a while now. And my sister wrote about a couple of weeks ago and said, you can write the judge. And you can write the judge and just tell him as he pronounces sentence upon the murderer. And so if you want to write the judge, here's his address and here's his name. So I wrote the judge. I wrote him Thursday. And I wrote this, I am an uncle of Joshua Ray Gilson. Josh, my nephew, was callously murdered by his wife almost a year ago there in Leavenworth. As you pronounce sentence upon her for her barbarous actions of hate, I ask that you do so with justice. And then I said, justice demands. And I went through seven things that justice demands that I thought of. All of them having to do with Josh's brothers, with Joshua's kids, with Joshua's parents. And how that justice demands that you think about what they've gone through. And then I ended it this way. Justice demands your own realization, Judge, that you are a minister of God, to be the revenger to execute wrath upon the one that doeth evil. Am I right? Yeah. He is the one. He has that responsibility. And I want him to know his God-given responsibility. And I went on to say, justice demands adherence to one of the first laws God gave in his establishment of human government on this earth, that whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. Indeed, as a judge, you have chosen a sobering profession. I trust that the sentence you render is based upon the faultless character of the one before whom we will all one day stand, 2 Corinthians 5:10, who said what is recorded in Genesis 18:25, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Hey, he is God's minister. He had better do what is right based upon the judge of all the earth and what he does. Verse 4 is a verse that is often used. Now, regarding the sword, does it not say in verse 4, he beareth the sword and he doesn't do it in vain? Here's something that I found in Vincent and his word studies in the New Testament. He is quoting, regarding the sword in verse 13:4. The sword is borne as the symbol of the magistrate's right to inflict capital punishment. The Emperor Trajan presented to a provincial governor on starting for his province a dagger. And he had inscribed on that dagger these words. Note this. Are you ready? This dagger is for me. If I deserve it, in me. In other words, you protect me with this dagger. But if I deserve it, use it on me. Wow. Think about that. That's what every ruler should understand. That the dagger is for the protection of the people, but if I ever go beyond my authority, use it on me. Folks, we have a Second Amendment in this country for a reason, and it's for that very reason right there. So this passage emphasizes how the authority put in place by God encourages the subjects to be morally good rather than bad. So if the ruler does not encourage the subjects to do good, is that ruler really an authority put in place by God? What about it when those rulers who try to remove the sword from those who are entrusted to wear it, those who are supposed to execute wrath upon them that doeth evil, what if the rulers try to take the sword away from those lower magistrates and defund the police? Are we supposed to forget the words good and evil in this whole passage? Are we supposed to think that those words are relative to the one who does the ruling? Or, oh, those words, do they really have meaning as to what is good and what is evil? Or are these words relative to God who defines what is good and evil? You'll notice that the word execute is in italics. A revenger into, literally, wrath upon them that doeth evil. Let me just give some illustrations. Critical race theory is unconstitutional. I've read article after article on that. It's clearly unconstitutional in the way it's taught and what it's doing. So Joe Biden and all the others are screaming about this Marxist ideology, clearly lying about it to an advance an agenda. He is the one who is violating the Constitution. Do we submit? Or do we stand up and say, this is wrong? He is violating his oath. Others who have done studies on Romans 13 use Daniel as an example. You want to know what the proper method of appealing is? Go to Daniel chapter 1. They were taken captive into Babylon, and they were going to make Daniel and his three friends eat certain things that they didn't think were right and to drink things they didn't think they should drink. What did Daniel do? He appealed, and you'll notice how he did so with great respect to the prince of the eunuchs there in Daniel chapter 1. That's how you appeal. But then you get to Daniel chapter 6. Now go to Daniel chapter 6, and I want to notice something because they will also use this, but I think they miss a few points here in Daniel chapter 6. Remember what Daniel 6 is about? Daniel's thrown into the lion's den. Well, how did that happen? You back up in the chapter. What was it that was said that caused him to be thrown into the lion's den? Daniel is one of the top rulers in the nation. He is set over the kingdom. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom, and over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was the first, that the princes might give accounts unto them and that the king should have no damage. Daniel was preferred, it says in verse 3. He had an excellent spirit, and the king even thought to set him over the whole realm. Verse 4, the presidents and the princes, the other guys, sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they couldn't find anything, no fault. He was faithful. There was no error, no fault found in him. So here's what these men concocted in verse 5. We're not going to find anything against this guy unless we find it concerning the law of his God. So in verse 6, they assembled together, went to the king, said to the king, all of us have gotten together to establish a royal statute, verse 7, to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any man or God for 30 days, except for you, O king, he will be cast into the den of lions. The king establishes the decree in verse 9. Now notice what Daniel does in verse 10. He knew that the writing was signed. He went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day. Stop right there. Where in the Bible does it say that when you pray, you have to kneel? Where in the Bible does it say you have to do this three times a day? But he did it. And his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem. Stop. Where in the Bible does it say that you need to kneel in front of a window that faces Jerusalem? and prayed and gave thanks before his God. Why was he doing it this way? As he did aforetime, what he did before. Now, folks, why didn't Daniel submit to this new law? That a network of laws, institutions, and officials put in place. Why didn't he submit? Well, you're supposed to pray. Do you have to pray three times a day? Do you have to do so kneeling? Do you have to do it in front of people in a window so that they see you doing it? Why didn't Daniel just go in private and pray like we do? I mean, how many of you guys pray three times a day, kneeling in front of a window so that everybody driving by can see you? Where am I going with this? Anybody catching this? He did not have to do that, but he did it. Why? Well, it does say he did it before, but he doesn't have to now. People today would say, well, you guys could just go meet in the woods. You don't have to have your church building. You can go meet, go up to the mountains and meet. That way nobody sees you and everything's fine. We say, no, we're going to meet together like we've always done. People say, you're defiant. Hey, let me show you another guy who was defiant in the Bible. That's the point I'm making here. Daniel was being defiant. So I'm saying, when you get to Romans 13, 4, in fact, the whole passage, there comes a point where you say, no, I am not going to do it. You could go hide. But I think Daniel's looking down the road. Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin proposed that the great seal of the United States depict Moses leading the Jews out of Egypt, Moses raising his rod to divide the sea, Pharaoh in his chariot overwhelmed by the waters, and the divine pillar of fire that led the Israelites by night. The seal's proposed motto, Paul, not that. That was supposed to be the motto. Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Did they understand something? We don't. What they were doing was not right. It was contrary to Romans chapter 13. Well, not so fast. Not so fast. Romans 13, 5. And I've said this before. Imagine that we had no government in this country. What would it be like? Total chaos. And really what's happening in this counter-revolution that's now taking place is this very thing. So when people say, oh, you guys are rebelling, no, we are countering a revolution that is trying to subvert our Constitution. We are trying to counter that. But if you imagine no government, then you think of Judges chapter 21 and other passages in Judges that say in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did that was right in his own eyes. We are not anti-government. We know we need a government. You have to have a government. But even as you look at Romans chapter 13, I read this. How many of you have a Scofield Bible? Man, it used to be every Christian, every Baptist had a Scofield Bible. What is wrong? Only Jerry and Paul and I? The one I preach from is not Scofield. You got a Scofield? Yeah. I mean, it used to be if you don't have a Scofield, man, you're... But I tell you, sometimes he had notes in there that were really good. And here's a note that he put on Romans 13 and verse 5. The verse does raise the perennial problem of striking a proper balance between strong central government and personal liberty. When was the Scofield Bible notes put in? Does anybody remember that, Brother Paul? I believe it was the early 1900s or into the teens when he wrote his notes. And then he says, compare 17:6, 18:1, and 19:1. And I'm misquoting here because it must have to do with another passage. And I'm trying to remember where it was. Oh, yeah, it's the Judges. He's making comment on the book of Judges. That verse, Judges 21:25, raises that perennial problem. 1909. There you go. Thank you. Any citizen can obey the law because of fear of punishment, but a Christian ought to obey because of conscience. That's what it says in Romans 13 right there. I need to keep my Bible. I need to keep a marker. I keep turning back. Verse 6 or verse 5. You must be subject not only for wrath, but also for conscience sake. Can you in good conscience obey somebody who's trying to destroy? Of course, if the government interferes with conscience, then the Christian must obey God rather than men. Then verse 6, for this cause pay ye tribute also. Now, the King James renders that as an imperative. It also can be read in the indicative mode. You say, what's the indicative? It's just a statement of fact rather than a command. In other words, like the NASV, for because of this, you also pay taxes. Here's why you pay taxes. Because they're God's ministers. They've got to be supported. That's why you pay taxes. So this is your justification, somebody said, for paying taxes to pagan rulers. They are God's servants. Now, here's the question. If you pay taxes, do you pay taxes to the Constitution or to the rulers? The Constitution does not accept you pay them in support of the Constitution. Brandon? Now, there's not, do you support everything that our taxes go for? Would Jesus have said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, the things that are unto God's, unto God's? Did they support everything that was happening in the Roman Empire? No. When you see the word custom there in verse, verse 7. Tribute to whom tribute, custom to whom custom. That's an indirect tax on goods. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. The things that are God's, the things that are God's. So, I've got to sew this up. Because I'm done with Romans 13 now. Who is the king in America? Again, I believe it is. And the reason I'm stressing that is because there are others, good men, who disagree with that. That will say, no. You do whatever they say. Unless it directly violates. If they say you can no longer meet for church, then you must disobey them. We all agree on that. If they say we're going to take away your guns without passing a law, they would say you need to submit. Now they're violating the authority. Can't take any questions. I'm done. Sorry. So come back next week. We're going to look at the date when Paul wrote this letter, the book of Romans, and who was in rule, because they use this argument a lot. Who was the Roman emperor at the time Paul wrote Romans? Nero, good or bad? You better wait on that. Lord, we thank you for your word. May we